reader. I'm Cindy Burnett. Welcome to my award-winning podcast, Thoughts from a Page, which is a member of the Evergreen Podcasts Network. On the show, I chat with authors whose books I have enjoyed about their new releases, and I give you a peek behind the curtain of the publishing industry with my Behind the Scenes series. With so many books coming out weekly, it can be hard to decide what to read, so I find the best ones and share them with you. If you're looking for a community of readers, bonus content, and a chance to read books before they hit the shelves, I hope you'll consider joining my Patreon group, which is filled with a wonderful bunch of book lovers. The link to join is in the show notes. Today, I am chatting with Amy Lynn about Hereafter. Amy's beautiful and lyrical book about the grief she experienced after the sudden loss of her husband is one of those books that will stay with me for a very long time. It will also make a wonderful gift for those you know who are struggling with grief. Amy is a writer and educator who lives in Calgary, Alberta. Her work has been published in Plowshares, and she has been awarded residences from Yaddo and Casa Comala. Hereafter is her first book. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
You've got questions, we've got answers. Business leadership, ownership, and sales can be challenging. Tune into the Accelerate Your Business Growth podcast to learn from the world's experts. Join me, your host, Diane Helbig, as I chat with people who have expertise in various areas of business. You'll enjoy the lively conversations that are focused on providing you with the ideas, tips, and suggestions you need to realize greater success. Get what you need for your business when you need it from the people who have the answers. Accelerate Your Business Growth is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Welcome, Amy. How are you today?
You know, I'm really wonderful because we've had the longest little winter in the world where I live, which is to say this month is always so much snow and you think there can't be more. But today the sun is out and the snow is melting. So it puts me in an excellent frame of mind, truthfully.
I totally get that. I'm on the flip side. I'm in Texas. So it is warm already here, and I would actually prefer the cooler weather, but I'm sure it just depends on what you're used to and what you've already experienced.
Exactly, totally.
So your book, Hereafter, is an incredibly powerful read, and I have been seeing so much praise for it. Congratulations.
Thank you. That's really kind. I've been so grateful for the reception that the book has received so far.
And I listen to it. I'm not a huge audiobook listener, but I do listen sometimes to memoirs and nonfiction. And you read it. So that was very powerful. I was glad I did that.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it was a project that I undertook without knowing a whole lot about what recording a book requires. And it was such a remarkable experience for me. It really was really difficult in some ways, but I was extremely glad to be able to speak it as close to the voice that I hear when I read the book. I'm so glad to hear that you listened to it. That's amazing. Thank you.
It was really well done. And you pause between each chapter, which we're going to talk in a minute about the format and how you decided to do it the way you did it. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because I speed mine up a fair amount, but there was still a pretty good pause between each chapter, which I felt kind of let me reset a bit. And I'm assuming that was sort of the purpose of you having a pause that was a little longer between each one as you read it.
Yeah. You know, it really relates to how much white space the physical book has. And I wanted to make sure when I pause between the chapters, I gesture towards this amount of white space. If you see a physical copy, the chapters live almost in the center of the page with these extraordinarily large margins of space, which has a couple different purposes. But one of them is exactly as you said, to allow readers to take a breath, to orient themselves to what they've just heard, and to also allow for the experience of grief, which often feels as if you are surrounded by white noise, as if you're floating, which was something that I wanted visually to render. And then when I did the audio recording, the spacing or the pacing of time between chapters was a nod towards that choice.
I am so glad we're talking about this because I never thought about that. I do have a physical copy. It's right here. And I was just opening it again to remind myself about all the white space. And I'm glad we chatted about that to connect it up with the audio space.
Yeah, it's such a interesting opportunity when you take what's written and you record in audio, because it really makes you think about how can I acknowledge what is also visually rendered on the page in terms of auditory intake. And I was so thankful for that. Something that the recording allowed me to access that I hadn't expected was that you sit in this very, very small room, essentially a closet, and it's totally dark, and you have these huge headphones clamped on your ears, and your voice is so loud in your own head that it becomes, and you record for these extraordinarily long amounts of time, hours and hours, and your own voice is so loud that it becomes as if it is separate from you, as if somebody else is actually speaking to you through these headphones. And I had this experience. We'd been recording for about 5 hours, and I finally took a break. And I went to the bathroom, and I kind of looked at myself in the mirror, and I thought to myself, I think all of these really sad things that have happened, I think these things happened to me. And I had a really strange experience of meeting with myself, the self that wrote the book and still very much is the person that I am, but I was reading in a time completely different from the time that I was speaking. And I felt that I had met a past version of the grief that I carry, and I was totally unable to explain to myself how it felt to look at that person in the mirror and say, well, one day you're going to feel differently. And one day you're going to feel as intensely this grief, but you're going to be speaking about it from a totally different world. And it was really extraordinary. I hadn't expected that when I recorded, to feel as if two different people were experiencing the same moment, even though they're both me. That sounds a little bit strange, but it really has remained with me.
Or very profound.
Yeah.
I can't believe you recorded for 5 straight hours. I was going to say, when I do this, I can't do more than probably 3 interviews in a day, or I start to just feel like I've talked myself silly. So I'm impressed that you were able to read and record for 5 hours.
It was also noted by the audio producer that that's quite unusual. I think, truthfully, I didn't know that we could take a break. I just thought we had to keep going.
You're like, they're never letting me out.
Yeah, it was because no one said, oh, let's pause here. And I just thought, okay, well, then we just keep going.
You set the record. Well, we kind of got off on the audiobook, where I usually will ask an author to give me a synopsis. So let's back up a little bit and talk about Hereafter for those that haven't read it yet.
Yeah, so Hereafter is a memoir about the grief that I experienced, as well as the death of my husband, who died in August of 2020. And it not only looks at my experience of grief as I moved through widowhood at a very young age, but also at the love that Curtis and I shared and the ways in which that love completely and in so many ways radically changed my life. It's also a book that's very much in pain. And I hope that it offers readers a mirror for how much pain we are often asked to hold as human beings. And that was something that I really wanted when I wrote it, was there are a lot of beautiful grief books that offer maps and guidebooks for grief, but I really wanted a mirror. I wanted somebody to tell me that they were also in this much pain.
Well, and we talked about this a little bit before we started recording. I didn't really find the guidebook super helpful personally when my parents passed away. The amount of pain I was feeling, the sadness, just the overwhelming feeling of it all. And so I've been happy to find your book and another book that I've read recently that are more of a mirror and make me realize and understand and feel better that I'm not the only one who feels like, can I even get out of bed today?
Well, that's exactly it. Is I do think those map books for grief serve certain kinds of readers and grievers. I just wasn't one of them. I also didn't find them very useful. And I really do believe that so much of work in grief, but so much of our work really as human beings, revolves around this idea of trying to witness and see what things are really like for people. And I really wanted books that witnessed how, just as you say, how incredibly painful and humbling and difficult it is to be in grief, and that there are so many things that grief asks of us that we are totally, completely ill-equipped to do. And I really believe that grief is a condition, a vast condition of being, that none of us actually can bear alone, and that it is something that actually requires witness and community, because it's something that we must carry with others. And I think books that offer that truth to us do the work of humanity, which is of saying that we see you, we see how it is for you, and that we're here too.
you're not alone, and others are going through something either similar to what you're going through, or at least something that kind of parallels what you're feeling.
Exactly.
Well, it definitely made me feel better and just continued to reinforce that time does help a little bit. Talking about it helps, and that slowly but surely it will get better. Portions of it.
I really feel that time does this strange thing to grief where it changes shape and we hold it differently. I was speaking recently with a widow whose husband just died. She's at month 8, which was a really difficult month for me, and I could tell it was very difficult for her. And she said, well, what do you mean? What do you mean that it changes shape? And I said, well, I mean that when Curtis died, grief for me was this totally vast, entirely all-encompassing landscape, and my whole life was covered with it. And there was nowhere that I could go that I could escape the intensity of grief. But with time, with quite a bit of time, truthfully, sometimes there is a small portion of my life where grief feels as if it is a lighter intensity, or the reach of grief maybe hasn't quite gotten to that moment or that place. And I get a moment where I feel like I'm in a territory that's connected to grief, but not entirely consumed by it. And I said, that kind of shape-shifting, I think, is a requirement of grief. I think grief has to exist with that kind of time because we know it's chronic. We know it's not going anywhere. And it can be really hard to hear that when you're in the land of it, when you can't see any possibility that it wouldn't always be the same intensity. And I do think that even if you get moments or days, which I do sometimes, that don't feel completely consumed by grief, you can just as easily turn a corner and be right back there. And that's a reality that I think most grievers live with, this idea that it's chronic and that it could be always soon, that I think grief is always soon, no matter how long it's been. And being able to understand that and tell people, I understand that, is a real gift to grievers and something that I don't know is maybe widely understood.
When I find that when I have a good day, or what I consider to be a better day than most, that it's almost always followed by a terrible day.
Yeah.
So I'm like, yay, I feel so much better. This is good. I've turned the corner, as you mentioned. And then the next day, everything falls apart. And I'm so sad and I just can't stop crying. So it's interesting. And I think you're right. I really misspoke. Time for me has made it better. I don't think it's ever going to be good. I mean, I think I will always miss my parents.
You know, that's the thing about grief. And I really believe this. And I've said it before, but I believe that grief is the final form of love. And that if we are lucky enough to be in relationship with people that we love, that we really know, whether consciously or unconsciously, that we will grieve them. And that that's what love ultimately asks of us, which is to carry grief when the people we love die before we do. And that's a really scary thing to face. There aren't a lot of people that really want to acknowledge that reality. They would prefer to look at the more glorious parts of love, which is how much it opens to us and how much it gives us and how much abundance it gives to us when we are lucky enough to be the recipient of it. But always there is that final ask, which is grief. And nobody would think that they would love their parents or their husbands or any of their beloveds who are gone less the more time goes on, which means that grief doesn't lessen, that our experience of it, just as our experience of loving people who have died must change, grief will change, but it will remain as steady as the love that bears it. And I think that's really hard for people to hold, which makes in turn grief sometimes hard for other people to hold or to witness.
You say it all so beautifully.
That's very kind, but it is also very ugly.
The thing itself is, but you have a way with words, which I found as I was listening to your book as well. I can say something and then you say it, and I'm like, oh my gosh, she said it like 1,000 times better than I did. Well, how did you decide on your format? Because it's different in a good way. Like, I actually really appreciated that. But tell me how you decided. First, I guess, tell me how you decided to tell the story. And then second, how you decided on your format.
Yeah. So I started Hereafter without intending to write a book, which is to say, 1 month after Curtis died, I began a Substack, which is a kind of newsletter called At the Bottom of Everything, which is a newsletter that I still write in. and it was about grief. My therapist at the time told me that I couldn't grieve alone, or that I shouldn't grieve alone. And I found it impossible to think about telling people directly what was happening to me or my experience of grief. And so I started writing publicly about it in this newsletter that I still continue to write in. And after a year, my agent, who I adore, was speaking with me, and she kind of just lightly asked if I thought maybe the Substack would be a book. And because I truthfully always wished to be my agent's favorite, I said yes, which was a lie because I hadn't thought about it. Projects like the Substack, which I adore, are so made in the time that they happen. But a book isn't made in time. It's actually made outside of time. And once I got off the phone with my agent, I panicked, truthfully, and I put everything that I had so far, which was a year's worth of writing, into a Word document. And I had 110,000 words, and I thought, oh, okay, well, that's a book length. But the problem was, I had a project. I didn't have a book. And it wasn't until I started limiting what I could say that I began to see The Shape of Hereafter, which is a totally different project in so many ways from the Substack. And I, for months, I would go page by page in the Word document, and I would allow myself to only keep 5 or 6 sentences from every page. And this kind of creation by elimination began to reveal to me the essential and the core things about my grieving experience that I wanted to say, that I felt were essential to say, and that I felt lived in a book. And so this was slowly and sort of painfully how Hereafter was born. And it's also why the chapters are as condensed and as small, sometimes only a single line on a page, as they are in the book, because grief is a process of intensity. It heightened so many things for me, and it stripped so many things away from me. And so then, of course, it made sense to me as I assembled the book that the process of making it would, of course, be a process of intensifying what was on the page and of taking things away, because that's what grief, or my experience of it, in so many ways did. And I also, the way that I assembled it, which is entirely in present tense, with these paragraphs that often move between vast different parts of my life, often on the page will be 7 years with Curtis or 1 year after grief, was really intentional because it had to mirror for me what my experience of grief was, which is that grief is always present tense, that the idea of a past and a present completely breaks when your loved one dies, the narrative of your life snaps. And time does too. And so there's no use in having tense anymore, because what is past, my marriage with Curtis, our relationship, feels as real to me as what is present, which is the fact that I am not married anymore and that Curtis has died. Those realities live in the now as if they are both true. That's my experience of grief. And I wanted that to render on the page. And I wanted readers to experience something that I experience in grief, which is that I am always looking for Curtis. Even now, I'll walk into a room of people and I'll think, oh, is Curtis here yet? And in the book, by moving non-linearly through time, I wanted readers to turn the page and wonder if Curtis would be around the corner. Because I think many of us, when we love people in grief, are still looking for them, even in the now. Grief never allows us to feel that they are past. We're always looking for them. And that really drove the way that I made the book.
Or you see people who look like them and it startles you for a second. And you think, oh, there's my mom.
Yes, absolutely.
I hate that.
I do too. I almost feel irrationally angry at that person. I think, how dare you look like him and cause me to go there for a second? And of course, this person is just, you know, they're walking to the bus. They are just living their lives.
Exactly. But it does. It makes you mad. Well, what was the hardest part of writing Hereafter? I mean, you've just talked a little bit about it, but was there something in particular that you really struggled with?
I think for me, the hardest part of writing Hereafter meant that I lived in the landscape, the territory of Curtis's death for a really long time. You know, I started writing about his death 1 month after he died, and I did not go, definitely not a week, but I would say certainly maybe not even a day where I didn't in some way continually come to this place of grief, which for so many people, they'll say, I don't even feel like I have words for the pain that I'm in. And that's how I felt. And I was constantly coming to this wordless landscape, trying to figure out how to speak with a new mouth and in a language that I didn't know yet. And I was literally trying to find the words. And I did that. I think when I counted, I had just turned the book in for submission and it was going to be out of my hands for a month, which meant that I wouldn't be working with Curtis's death for a month. And I counted how many days it had been. And I think I had lived in those moments for over 1,500 days, which is an extraordinary amount of time. And it's very hard to continue to go back to the dark, wordless place of pain and try to find the words for it. And usually in grief therapy, they encourage you actually to not try to do that every day, to try to have days where you don't go there. But it was literally my job to find the words with the book and with what I felt I could offer to Curtis and the way that I could carry him. And I found that really intensified so many of my emotions. And I was much wearier when I turned the book in than I realized. Not something that was lost on the people that love me, but was a little bit lost on me because I had never even tried to go a day without living in the hours and the months and the years after Curtis had died.
So that had to be shocking for you as well to lose that thing that you've been focused on for so very many days.
It was certainly strange. I don't know that I felt a loss. I think I was so exhausted by the time I turned the book in that I was grateful for an opportunity to put some of it down. And the book really feels that way to me. It feels like a place where I put some of what I needed to say. And it was a place where I could meet with my own pain. And when I turned it in, and when it became the book that it is now, I also allowed myself to get some distance from it and explore a different part of my grief experience. I don't find writing cathartic because it's a matter of survival to me. I don't think when we toss someone who's drowning a life ring and then they hold on to it, we say, oh, well, did you find that cathartic? they don't. You know,
right,
they,
right. That would be weird. Right.
Really, they're relieved to be somewhere different. They're relieved to have something to hold on to, but they're certainly not experiencing catharsis. And writing is that for me. It's a place certainly that I am so grateful to have something to hold on to, but I don't find it cathartic. But I had that experience of the life ring when I turned the book in. I thought, okay, it's finally something to hold on to. And it's a kind of solid ground that I can put beneath my feet. And I was very grateful for that. And I was truthfully grateful for the month that I stepped away from it because I did experience a different shade of grief in that month.
Good. I'm glad. And I'm glad it was time for you to take a break from at least those aspects of it.
And I think it was necessary. And I knew that working with my grief therapist that I was going to need to take some time entirely away from the book. It's just the realities of my deadlines didn't allow me to until that moment.
Exactly. Well, let's talk about the physical book itself. It's smaller.
Yes.
We've talked a little bit about the pages and the fact that there's not so many words on each page. There's a fair amount of white space. So tell me about making the book smaller. Also, tell me about the title and the cover.
So I'm so lucky because my press really welcomed me into the design experience, which is not, they didn't have to do that. You know, my press did not have to include me in the design experience. But I was really thankful that they did because I had a lot of notes. The trim size of the book came from one of the things I expressed in our initial design meeting, which was that I said, I hope that people who are grieving read this book. And I hope that people who want to support people who are grieving read this book. And I hope people who have no idea about grief read this book. And the thing that unites all three kinds of people is that it's unlikely those people will be able to read any book in one sitting. Because if you're grieving, you probably can't focus, or I certainly could not read for a very long time, for long periods of time. And if you're supporting people who are grieving, you have a lot to do and you're worried about a lot of things. And if you're exploring the territory of grief or wondering about it, you're also likely busy. We're all busy, which means I said, people need to be able to carry this book with them. It needs to fit inside a bag that you would take on the train. And I have so many beautiful hardbacks in my house that I love, but they're so large. It's like they've been delivered on flatbed trucks. I cannot fit them anywhere. I don't own a bag big enough. And I said, the book needs to be holdable. It needs to be easily carried. And I asked that it be smaller in size. And they really heard me. And I love the size of it because it does. I've tested it in several bags and it feels good. You know, it really.
You're running all over your house, sticking it in this bag, sticking it in that bag.
I really did, yes. And the cover, which is by Anna Morrison, who's a beautiful designer, I really love it. We did several rounds where she really listened carefully to the things that I wanted. And, you know, I wanted a sense of the different kinds of time that are in the book, which I was really evoked with these overlapping circles that at their most simple offer a past and a present and a shared well of memory. But also I wanted a sense of longing that grief, I think, really gives to all of us, whether we like that gift or not. This idea of the divers reaching for each other in a kind of gesture that will never fully be met, but that is eternal, felt very much like grief to me. And the tight contrast between the blue, which feels to me like a color most people would associate with grief, the blues is very often used. And I didn't want that to be the dominant color. I wanted this red, which I suggested and Anna brought a beautiful shade to the table of, because grief for me feels like that, like a fire, like an intensity, like a burning. And I wanted that to live in contrast to this idea of the blues that we so often think of when we think about things that are sad. And it came together in this cover, which I really love. And I'm really grateful to Anna for creating. The title itself, Hereafter, gestures in a couple different directions, most obviously to my position of being here after Curtis has died, after my life has changed, after grief has so strongly gripped my life, but also it references the here of our life and our love, which still lives with me. And it also gestures towards what comes after. What do you do? How do you continue when someone you love has died?
Well, I love the title and I love the cover because red is my favorite color on a much lighter note for the red.
It's also Curtis's favorite color, which is something that I really loved when we saw the cover.
I also love that you had so many thoughts about it. And I really like the size. I think you're exactly right. It's something you can just take with you wherever you go.
Yes, exactly. And I hope that people do. I hope they pass it from person to person or carry it with them as a sort of talisman. I tend to do that. I carry books with me that I'm not even reading, but because they offer something to me and I feel just a little bit safer with them physically in my bag.
That makes sense. Well, before we wrap up, Amy, what have you read recently that you really liked?
I will say that grief totally shattered my ability to read. It was actually not until about 3.5 years that I began, that was in January, that I began to feel as if I could read again. But some things that I love and that I have read decently recently would be, well, 3 books come to mind. Oh, 4, actually. Of course, I'm obviously a massive book nerd, so this is a slippery slope for me. But I really love The Summer Book by Tove Jansson, who's perhaps most famously known for The Moomins, which is a beautiful series written for children, but is perfectly endearing to adults. But The Summer Book is entirely for adults. And it is the story of a grandmother and her granddaughter who live on a very remote island. And I think it might be a perfect novel. I don't want to say anything else because it is so crystalline and unto itself, but it's beautiful. And I also recently read Laura Vandenberg's forthcoming State of Paradise, which is a strange, bizarre look at Florida and what happens when we live in a landscape that is as strange as our actual emotions and feelings, but also somehow is fueled by the oddness of living. I think Laura Vandenberg is one of our best speculative writers, and I really loved the time I spent in her book. And the last book that I have come back to recently, but that I've read on and off throughout my, I would say for at least 2 decades, is Michael Ondaatje's Running in the Family, which is a memoir that's based simply on his return to his home country and his desire to understand more about where he's come from. And it's not based in any kind of trauma, which is a little bit unusual in the world of memoir. And it weaves these magical stories that his family holds, some of which are objectively true and some of which are emotionally true, into his own idea of who he is and what it means to be part of the landscape of a family. It's beautiful.
I'm not even familiar with that one, but it sounds wonderful. I'm going to immediately look it up when we're done.
It's really, really, it's really incredible.
Okay. Well, Amy, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. And I cannot wait for people to read your book. I know it's already out in the world and many people have been, but hopefully this introduces more readers to it.
I certainly hope that Hereafter is a place that people can meet with themselves and their own pain and with Curtis. And I'm so grateful to you for taking the time today. Our time is so precious and it means a lot to me that you would spend yours with me.
Absolutely. I'm so glad we got to chat.
Hello, and welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo, and for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book, and together, we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our ninth season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi there. I'm Heather Drago.
And I'm Sarah Saunders.
We host the podcast, That's a Hard No, about saying no and setting boundaries.
So you can become that true and empowered you that this world needs. Saying no isn't just okay.
It's the key to living an authentic, fulfilling life.
I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor. So while this podcast is in no way a replacement for one-on-one therapy, I suppose I know what I'm talking about.
I'd say so. We talk about learning to say no and set healthy boundaries and how it impacts mental health, physical health, relationships, parenthood, and more.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit our website, hardnopodcast.com.
We're here to help you find your no and say it unapologetically.
That's a hard no.
Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. I would love to connect with you on Instagram or Facebook, where you can find me at Thoughts From A Page. If you enjoy the show, please consider joining my Patreon group to access bonus content and support the podcast. If you have a moment to rate the show or subscribe to it wherever you listen to your podcasts, I would really appreciate it. It makes a big difference. And please tell all of your friends about Thoughts From A Page. Word of mouth does wonders to help the show grow. The book discussed in this episode can be purchased at my bookshop storefront, and the link is in the show notes. I hope you'll tune in next time.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
Science! 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 Science!
Hello, podcast fans. Want to get weird with us? Come check out the Mad Scientist Podcast. We are a weekly show that looks at the history, philosophy, and hard facts behind your biggest paranormal questions.
Did the government really pay for a psychic spy program?
Yes!
Is it true that surgery got its start in grave robbing?
Yes!
Can a roller coaster really kill you?
Legally, we can't say so for sure, but sometimes, yes! Join myself, Chris Cogswell, and my co-host, Marie Mayhew, as we examine the science, philosophy, and history behind the strange and unusual. All to discover what's possible and plausible versus what's, well, just made up. Check us out wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The Mad Scientist Podcast.